This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show. Filling your head with naughty feminist ideas since 2007. Is a syndicated show produced in Vancouver, BC, Canada at CFRO 100.5, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. For more information about the F-Word Media Collective, you can go to our website at feminisms.org. You can hear our shows through that site, plus coopradio.org, rebel.ca, archive.org, Pacifica Radio, and iTunes. And every week, we broadcast live from the downtown east side of Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territory. I'm Ariana Bearer, in the studio today with Pragya Sharma, Carissa Raponin on tech, and Angela Matthews, also of the F-Word. On today's show, I will be speaking with Pragya about the importance of kindness in activism. To give or not to give the hero sandwich, no shame invitations to accountability, connections to the land, feminism, white supremacy, orienting to action, and that voice inside all of us that sometimes asks, who am I to do this? So today we're honored to have Pragya Sharma in the studio with us, speaking about ways that we can shift our thinking around struggles for social change. Pragya identifies as a fat, brown, cisgendered, queer person who's been an educator, group facilitator, and support worker in the anti-violence field and in and out of organizing over the past 10 years in Alberta and British Columbia. Pragya, we're so happy to have you here.
Hi.
Hi. So I'd love for you to start off by talking a little bit about something that has been really important, and you and I have been speaking about this a lot lately. One of the things that you always do when facilitating groups is to begin with a connection to the land or the territory that we're on. Why do you think it's so important to begin with this when talking or organizing around social or environmental justice?
I think Harsha Walia actually said it really well in a recent article that she wrote about how in Canada everything is kind of based on settler colonialism. And I think that's why. And everything cuts through that. And not just cuts through that, but is really interlocked with settler colonialism. So I don't think it's possible to talk about feminism or violence work, or which is most of the work that I've done. I don't see how we can possibly talk about that without talking about colonization and the land that we're on and who had to die for us to be here.
Right. Can you speak a little bit more to settler colonialism?
Yeah. In terms of what it is,
or yeah,
how I think
what
of it.
Is.
It?
Yeah.
I guess I think of it as like a huge structure and a process in which people who have migrated to this land start to think of it as our own and start to forget that it's not. I know that for me, that was a huge process. There was a time when I was just like, oh yeah, people of color. And I used to put myself in with Indigenous folks until I realized that was totally not. I'm a settler here. So my life here, it has only been able to exist because of the attempted genocide of Indigenous peoples here.
Some of my learning around that, too, has been that while we are fighting to access rights that the state can grant us, just the very existence of the state is built on that colonization of a land that is not ours. Right.
Yeah.
So while it's really important for people to be able to access the freedoms and the safety and the justice that they need, we need to be thinking about whose backs is that on and who we can actually see our liberation tied in with.
Absolutely. I think this plays out so much when we talk about sexualized violence and violence against women. I know a lot of time, including some of the work that I've done, we focus so much on legal definitions of consent, legal definitions of sexualized violence, but whose lives actually matter about that and who actually benefits from a legal discourse around sexualized violence and consent. And it's not people who are victimized by the state, for sure.
Right. What should we be asking for beyond a legalized discourse?
That's an amazing question. I want to look at relationships of power. That's where my interest tends to be on. And I think legalized discourses totally forget about that and purposely erase that. So I'm interested in more than just did somebody give consent or not, as if it's just something you can take from somebody. But I want to look at what are relationships of power like and what are constant negotiations like. And this isn't just a yes or no sort of thing. Rapes that happen at borders have nothing to do with consent. And people that are raped in refugee camps, that has nothing to do with consent. I'm interested in those things too.
Thank you. I think I'm really glad that you brought up power, and I think that has such a big role to play in working through that, acknowledging that, and and struggling with it in the work that we're doing with feminisms and with work to fight against misogyny and white supremacy and colonialism. Can you talk about some of the things that you see going on with those movements right now, from your perspective and your experience? Are people talking about power? Like, what needs to be happening? I think that that's a great example around us fighting around consent, but also yeah. we could be looking at beyond consent when it comes to sexualized violence. What else are you seeing, and what would you love to see?
I find that a really tough question to answer, and I think part of that's because I'm so in and out of organizing spaces. And since I moved to BC about 3 years ago, I'd say I've been more out than in. So I find that question a really tough one to answer. I can say from my experiences and what I see that there's the mainstream discourse, which is very much focused on consent, and then we see stuff that is happening underneath that, kind of the belly of that. I see like friends and people that I know organizing around really amazing stuff that has to do with power dynamics and looking at how gentrification in the downtown east side is linked to sexualized violence, looking at how the development of condos is linked to sexualized violence, looking at the cost of housing in Vancouver, looking at all those different factors that all interplay with one another to make sexualized violence happen and to make it okay and to make it something rewarding for people.
I used to, in my organizing, in my activist experience, I used to be able to see these issues as really siloed. And right. we can just talk about sexualized violence, or we can just talk about gender. And I'm really learning here in my experiences in Vancouver that we actually have to look across the different, I guess, the different fights, the different struggles that people are in to see how they're totally linked together, yeah. that housing is completely related to the work that I do around sexualized violence and poverty and all of those pieces and colonization.
Always. Yeah, absolutely. They completely interlock with each other. And it's kind of interesting because there's different ways of talking about it. I've heard people say like, intersecting oppressions as if they cut through each other. But I don't think that's just what happens. I think we really hold each other up. White supremacy does not exist without patriarchy, and patriarchy does not exist without white supremacy. Same thing with capitalism. We need each other. All the oppressions need each other in order to exist and thrive.
I think I found that really overwhelming to begin with, yeah. the idea of like, oh, how am I going to wrap my head around this and really see it, especially as like a cisgendered person. So yeah. the gender I was assigned at birth is the one that, you know, works for me and how I walk in the world and how I'm read in the world. And also as a person who gets read as white too. And so it was really a learning process for me to see those pieces interacting and how they are totally inseparable.
Yeah.
And I think when I look at it in terms of the organizing that people are doing, it actually makes me feel less alone to know that like the issues that I'm struggling for are totally connected to the issues that other people are struggling for as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it really speaks to how we really need to support other issues that may not seem directly impacted by ours. I remember when I was doing my first graduate degree in Britain, there was this march against racism happening because there is a lot of stuff. I was doing it in Manchester, which is a very, very white supremacist place in different ways than anywhere I've lived before it is. And there, I was kind of part of the Women's Center, not really, but sort of. And there was a march happening against racism. And the Women's Center didn't want to get involved because they were like, well, this has nothing to do with women. And so then I was like, what? What are you talking about? Of course, it has everything to do with women. Are you saying that there's no women of color that are impacted by racism or white supremacy happening here? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I hope that they've since been able to see those connections.
I don't know. I hope so, too.
I hope so. Yeah. Thank you for talking about that. I'd also like to know, so I guess I've talked about some of the things that like have been tricky for me in getting involved in wrapping my head around things, but then mm-hmm. also the ways that that's actually really pulled me in even more.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, and I mean, that's a great example. What happened in Manchester is like, that's totally alienating. That's not something that would invite you to see that as a place that you could organize from.
Yeah.
So necessarily, what do you think are some of the reasons that people hesitate to be involved, to join social movements and environmental movements and to be a part of acting for change, for justice?
I think there's a million reasons. I can speak for myself, reasons that I hesitate to be involved. And sometimes I'll go to a meeting and feel like, oh, I don't really belong here. I think there's so much. I think part of it is this huge fear of messing up and this huge fear that if I mess up, that means that I'm a totally oppressive, horrible person and that I have no right to be here. I think there's also this idea that we have nothing to offer, which I know I often feel. And I remember when I first moved to Vancouver from Edmonton, I went to a couple of meetings here and people totally knew like everything that was going on. And I was so new. I didn't really have much to say. And we'd do rounds being like, well, what do you think about this type of action? And I'd be like, I don't know. And I just felt like, well, what do I have to give here? I have nothing. So I would just walk away because I felt like I was more of a burden than anything else. And I started talking to other people about that. And they were like, yeah, I feel the same way. And I think that's something that pervades a lot of us. And I think a lot of it is also shame, you know, like if we're involved a little bit and something happens in our lives and we have to step out, then it's really difficult to get back in. We feel like people think we don't care, and it's really hard to say that we do. And I'm speaking for myself there. Maybe I'm just using we because it's easier than just saying me. But there's also, you know, what you talked about before, Ariana, about, you know, who am I to be doing this work? And I had this feeling before coming in here today. I was like, who am I to be being interviewed about this? I'm not like this hardcore activist organizer here, someone that cares and has a lot of passion, but there's not a lot I've done in the past few years. So who am I to be talking about any of this? I think that comes up a lot. Who am I? I didn't even know. Who am I to be doing this protest, to be part of this march, to be organizing?
I think it's really important that you mention shame too, in particular. Where do you think that comes from? Like, what role does shame play?
Oh, I think saying shame is so huge. I think it's all pervasive. I'm just kind of figuring out what it means for myself. I know for myself it's very closely tied to perfectionism, and it's very closely tied to this feeling like if I don't do it completely right, then I've totally screwed up and I don't have any right to even be doing this at all. I remember some of that happening with Take Back the Night marches that I've helped organize, and we'd be organizing amongst a group of women, and then suddenly we'd realize, oh, I'm the only woman of color that's a part of this, and then feeling like, who are we to be doing this? Should we even be holding this march if there's only one woman of color on this board? And then it would be like, but then what do we do? Do we just stop? Do we change? Like, I think ideally it would be we change what we're doing so that more women of color feel like it's something that matters to them. That's not a place I was at the time. I didn't realize that. So then I just felt like I totally messed up and I did something that was really harmful and I just didn't want to do anything.
Yeah. I think it can be really easy to feel like if I'm not going to do this right, as if there is a right way to, or if it's not going to be good enough, or if I'm going to make mistakes, then it's better for me to just not. And then we lose out on people's gifts and people's passion and we can do differently. I was at a talk today by Deborah Britzman, who is a theorist and a psychoanalyst
she
and a
was
feminist.
Here? She was here. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's awesome.
There was a huge call out for it. It was a little bit quiet, I guess, but people meant to have it as a free public event. And she was talking about mistakes.
Yeah.
And this idea that we kind of connect mistakes to the need for correction instead of mistakes and meaning and meaning making, and that really tied for me, it really connected to some things that I've seen you do when you facilitate workshops around being able to speak to your own learning. And so for me, that really helped me with shame, because I could see you tell this story from like, okay, I was over here and now I'm over here with my thinking or with what I'm doing in the world. And so it made me feel less shameful for not being at that second place yet. It was like, it's okay for me to be here. Yeah. And that, like, I'm somewhere along this way of getting to this other place where I can have more understanding of what's going on in the world. I can be more useful. I can be a part of this. You gave a workshop on white supremacy that I was at. And I think I can definitely speak for myself and for the other women that spoke to me after, that they walked away feeling like they could be a part of doing something instead of being connected to shame. I think that's really, really important. They were uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think that's important for sure. And they identified that people could be angry.
Yeah.
And that's really important. And but that there was something they could do about it.
I'm really glad to hear that, because I know from my own experience of being a part of workshops, especially ones that are around anti-oppression in any sort of way, I leave feeling more more frozen than I did before I went in. I leave feeling very, like, too heavy to do anything and too implicated to do anything. And it's not that the heaviness feeling and the implication isn't important. Like you said, it absolutely is. But I try to organize things so that people don't feel ashamed. And I don't think guilt is necessarily always bad, but I also think it's not necessarily useful. So I remember we were talking about this after the workshop, and I was saying that I think there's a place for different types of responses. But when I'm organizing a workshop, and if I know there's going to be a lot of white folks there, my responses to things are going to be very different than if it's something annoying that a partner has said to me, or that a friend has said to me, or that I know what's happening at a party, because my purpose is to incite change. Whereas in other situations, my purpose may be to protect myself. It could be to unleash anger. It could be many other things. But in a workshop space, if I want people to leave that workshop feeling like they should be doing something, I don't want to shame them into that, because that's not going to work. That's not going to do anything.
Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to touch more on that after the break. This is the F Word. We are so happy to have Pragya Sharma with us on the F Word today. She is a self-identified fat, brown, cisgendered queer person who's been an educator, group facilitator, and support worker in the anti-violence field and in and out of organizing over the past 10 years in Alberta and BC. If you're just joining us now, we've talked about the importance of starting from an acknowledgement and connection to the land or territory that we're on to contextualize all our work and ground ourselves in that oppression and the resistance of that. What's going on right now with social movements, with feminism and the connecting movements as well? And what might keep people from joining in the struggles, like shame, perfectionism, and having a sense of who am I to do this? So we've been talking about being able to really invite people in to being a part of social change work, and sometimes we can do that through the work that we do at facilitating discussions, but then also how do we navigate pieces like that in our lives too? When can we speak up? When do we need to take care of ourselves? So thanks again for being here, Pragya.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real honor.
It is all the honor of the effort to have you here. Can you talk about some of the ways that people can be welcomed into organizing for change, and what it might look like to be invited to accountability? What do we mean by that?
Those are big questions. I guess I think of it as a tension between different things. And I'm just thinking about when I think about the stuff that I said before about how there's a lot of shame and there's a lot of like, who am I to be doing this? And I think a big thing for me was letting go of how much of this had to be about me, and thinking about, this isn't actually about me. This isn't about who I am. This is about what I want for my children and what I want for my grandchildren and what I want for this world and for other people that are living here, what I think is possible for us. And so I think there's a tension between that around me being accountable to myself and letting go of that ego piece. But I think there's also this piece that we can do differently in movements where I do think we can be more welcoming, because I don't think we really are. And I remember, I think Andrea Smith said it really well. She was in town recently and she talked about how, I don't remember if she talked about this here or if this was another talk, but I remember some talk of hers where she talked about how she was looking at churches with a friend of hers, thinking about, well, why do people like being involved in religious kind of stuff? And she talked about how welcoming they were, how friendly they were. And when she was at UBC, she was like, well, why do we expect people to join our movements when we make them feel like all the time? Why would they want to when they've had a really hard day too? And if they can just go home and watch TV, why would they be a part of our movement? So I think something in that is making everybody feel like they have something to offer just by being there, just by being who they are. I don't think there's anything wrong with pointing out when people make mistakes. I think that's really important. But I think the way we do that can be different. Mia Mingus is this amazing woman based out of the Bay Area, and she does a lot of work around transformative justice and child sexual abuse, as well as disability justice. And she does a lot of talk about how we all need each other, and how if we're working in movements with each other, with people that are involved in that movement building, we can't look at ourselves like we're disposable, and that we treat each other like we're disposable a lot of the time. When we mess up, we'll call them out in a way that completely alienates them, that prevents other people from wanting to be friends with them, and we totally exclude them so that other people are afraid that's going to happen to them too. So who wants to be involved in movement building when that's the kind of stuff that's happening?
Absolutely. It can really make people feel like they don't have anything to offer. It wouldn't be a space for them.
Absolutely.
That would be for somebody else.
Yeah.
You and I have talked about this idea of whether or not to give the hero sandwich.
Yes.
So you and I had an encounter where I was talking about working through my understandings of whiteness and white supremacy. And you said to me, I'm glad you're doing this.
Yeah.
And at the time I was like, it meant so much for me for you to say that. You weren't saying like, you've got it all right. Like, you can go home now and watch TV. And it's not that I deserve a hero sandwich for like trying to figure out white supremacy. I should be doing that. But it was just a really, it made me feel like I wanted to keep doing what I was doing.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah. So, but it's interesting because I've also heard, you know, the flip side, which is like, we really shouldn't be giving people hero sandwiches.
Yeah.
That's sort of the perspective they come from. And it really, it surprised me and it drew me in when you talked about the importance of kindness in activism.
Yeah. I guess I think about it as it relates to many things. One of them is, I want to be the kind of person I want to see in the world. I don't want to be an asshole. It doesn't make me feel good. I know that some people really thrive on that, and there have definitely been moments in my life where it has felt really good to be mean to somebody who's being an asshole. Definitely. But the place I'm at now, it doesn't feel good anymore. So I want to be kind, and I want to see like the personness in everybody that, and the capacity to be the person that they want to be too in everybody. And the thing that it came to with you was that I know that you were doing work that was really hard to do. And I think that, well, I know that white people are credited all the time for upholding white supremacy. They get rewarded for that constantly. As a cis woman and an able-bodied woman, I get rewarded constantly for being ableist, for being cis-sexist, for being transphobic. I'm constantly rewarded for those things. So why not try to level that out just a little bit? When I notice somebody working hard and working through something challenging, just to say that I'm glad they're doing it, like that's, I don't see anything wrong with that. At the same time, I don't want to say that we have to respond that way all the time, because we don't. And I would never want to tell anybody else how they should be responding. But I have noticed that when I respond that way, people get mad at me for doing that. And they're like, oh no, you shouldn't be doing stuff like that, because it really perpetuates this idea that that's something special to be doing. But then I would just start thinking, well, it kind of is something special to be doing. Not many people really work through their own stuff, and it's really important to be doing. I think the time that it gets challenging is when we reward a certain person, but not somebody else. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of anti-violence work I was doing, if I'd work with men would get rewarded. I was at like conferences where people would say, oh, let's stand up for all the men that are here, and people would applause, but nobody would stand up for the women. So that is absolutely valid to be honoring everybody that's doing that work.
I was just thinking about, you know, when men get celebrated for, like, babysitting
Absolutely.
Their own kids.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that's called parenting,
yeah.
You know? And it's like, we can be really glad that in a culture that tells men they don't have to do work in the home, that they don't have to do caring work, or in fact, that they're not good at it and they shouldn't be doing it,
yeah.
That that's not important in masculinity, that we can say, I'm glad you're doing this.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's great that you're doing this. I like the way you did this specific thing, like that. See, you know, those kinds of things. And also that's not always required, that we we can have a multitude of responses. And that this is a really valid one.
For sure. And I think it's kind of, if we acknowledge that we live in an oppressive society, we have to acknowledge that it's easier to be oppressive than it is to not be. So we have to look at that, and we have to honor that.
Absolutely. It's courageous to try to do the thing that you are not daily encouraged to do in multiple ways.
And that we're often criticized for doing, that we lose friends for doing, that we lose family for doing. I know white folks that have lost really close relationships because of work that they've done around whiteness. I know for me, I lost close relationships because of work that I've done around race and around colonialism and around all kinds of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. And I would love to keep talking about shame and the ways that we can imagine leaving shame out of all of this.
Yeah.
And I think you and I were talking a bit about Brené Brown and the work that she's done around vulnerability and, you know, and we've talked about like maybe guilt can be useful sometimes, but like shame is this really harmful thing. And maybe the antidote to that is being in a place of vulnerability and being sort of okay with that and creating spaces where people will feel like they'll be heard.
For sure. Yeah, I'm big on that.
Yeah.
It's something that I've been trying to do over the last few years when I've been trying to work through my own relationship with perfectionism and how much it's really gotten in the way of me doing things that I want to be doing. When I look at, you and I did a workshop recently, Ariana, where we did this exercise like about, well, who am I and who do I want to be? And I just realized that perfectionism really gets in the way of being who I want to be because I'm too scared to do anything. I'm too scared to talk to this person that I think is really rad. I'm too scared to show that I care. I'm too scared to show that I'm hurt. I'm too scared to do anything. So it and again, I think it's so much of a tension of letting go of the ego and also really nourishing that ego and being like, I'm awesome because I'm here and because I'm breathing and because I've survived and because I'm going to continue trying, and that I can take criticism and not let it destroy who I think I am or who I want to be, but also not let it prevent me from doing things. And because I know that absolutely happens, it prevents me from organizing, because it prevents me, I get so scared of being called out that I don't want to be in a lot of spaces. And that's partly my responsibility, absolutely, that I need to continue working on.
I get scared too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's okay to, it's great to say that. Thank
it
you.
It is. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I know, like when talking with friends about it, they're like, oh my God, do you feel that way too? Because there's other people that I'm friends with in my communities that I think are amazing, that do this radical work constantly. And I just assumed we never have those feelings. But it's interesting when being a little bit vulnerable, when taking that risk, oftentimes people feel kind of similarly, or if not, have felt that way at one point. And it can be a really great experience to grow from.
It's so easy to think that everybody else has it figured out already.
Yeah.
They already know what they're doing.
And they don't. Totally. I think that's part of what we do in our movements, too. We try to make it seem like we do, that we know everything, to like get some kind of credibility within this really screwed up world, that we come out as really confident and that we know exactly what we're talking about. And sometimes that's important. Sometimes we do. But then what happens to the people that don't? I don't know. I think a lot of it's connected with even with mental health, you know, like I know I struggle with anxiety and I know lots of people that do. So it's just like trying to be in a space and hold that for each other, including ourselves.
And naming all of those pieces and sharing that with other people and being able to track back to when we didn't know, when we didn't have things figured out, and acknowledging that we don't continuously, is like it's a roadmap. It helps us if there's another time that we had a huge piece of learning and then we got to where we are now, then we can do it again.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. Individually and as communities.
Absolutely.
I would love to sort of finish off by talking about resistance and how we can recognize and honor it in its many, many forms. And I think that what you just talked about is such a great example about being able to take that risk and share and be vulnerable. And yeah, resistance looks like a lot of things.
It does look like a lot of things. I think part of it looks like looking at our own resistance as individuals. How do we even survive this really screwed up world? How do we keep going? And I think a lot of it is, that to me is one of the things that helps eradicate shame, is looking at that, yeah, I did these things that were kind of f***ed up and I shouldn't have done them. And I should be more involved in stuff because it makes me happy. And it also is part of my responsibility being on this land. And there was a time when I didn't even think about a lot of those kinds of issues. So absolutely, I do think that looking at where we were and where we're going can be really helpful.
Thank you so much again for being with us here
today.
Thanks
so much for having me here.
It's been great.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show, effing up the airwaves since 2007.